Tonight's class is the fifth on Dogen's Genjo Koan. And tonight we're just studying a couple lines again. Yes, page 49 of the chant book. And if you were here for the recitation this evening, then you got a link to the online version of the Genjo Koan. This is just as a very brief review in case you are not familiar with this. Dogen is a Zen master in our lineage, considered the father of Soto Zen in Japan. He was a very prolific teacher and writer who lived from 1200 to 1253 in Japan. And he's written many, many things, but Genjo Koan is one of the most famous of his essays. And I like to think that it contains the essence of Zen. It's very rich, and if you could only have one Zen text, I would probably recommend this one. There's, as I've said in past classes, as an intro, the kind of study that we're doing hopefully will not strike you as over-intellectual. We are not studying a text like this in order to fill our head with more concepts or ideas, or become an expert on Zen, or to obsess about what we think Dogen thought and what he meant or whatever. We are engaging in this kind of study because of what it says, what it can do for our own practice, for our own experience of the Dharma. So I like to think that Buddhist study isn't about accruing more ideas, it's about challenging the ideas we already have. So we wrestle with the words, we wrestle with the concepts, and in the process, it's the process that matters, I should say. It's not walking away with like, okay, now I understand, now I get that. I mean, if you've done very much of this study, you know you rarely ever have that experience, right, of walking away like, oh, okay, right, I get it. You walk away going, well, that was interesting. It's like the understanding which we do gain over time is kind of like getting wet by walking in a mist. You do gain a sense of these things over time, but only by living it and letting it stew a little bit. So, Genjo Koan, the translation that we tend to use is translated as actualization of reality, or the realized universe. And reality meaning the world, not the meaning the world that to which we can awaken, which is in contrast to the world as we tend to perceive it through the filter of our assumptions and delusions and self-interest. So we're trying to, that's what the process of awakening is, trying to see through the filter we put over reality and to relate to perceive reality directly. And when we do, we see it has two aspects. It has the relative or the dependent aspect of time and cause and causation and right and wrong and me and you and all of that stuff. But it also has an independent dimension or an absolute dimension where everything is just as it is. And without any expectation, without any mental overlay, reality is just the way it is. And it's actually precious just the way it is. So there's these two aspects, And Genjo Koan is about how do we live that reality? How do we live that reality that has these two aspects instead of being just caught in the relative and dependent dimension? Or just perhaps having a taste of this independent dimension, but then what do you do with that? What does that have to do with your everyday life? So that's what Genjo Koan is about. So tonight we are working on the paragraph. I'm trying to go through this as fast as I can, but as I realize, like, as I look at it, I'm like, wow, we're going to be studying the Genjo Koan for a long time. Trust me, if it gets old, we'll just take a break and do a little different series and then go back to it. But so this is the section, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they don't need to perceive they are Buddhas. However, they are enlightened Buddhas, and they continue actualizing Buddha. In seeing color and hearing sound with body and mind, although we perceive them intimately, the perception is not like reflections in a mirror or the moon in water. When one side is illuminated, the other is dark. So first we're going to concentrate on that first sentence. The second part, I will try to save some time to get to. It's a little more obscure and less accessible, I think, than the first, and I think we can probably get plenty of meat out of the first. So as I have been doing in the past, I'm going to share with you the kanji for this sentence. I have some 3D copies for the Dirt Zendo, and then I will share my screen if you want to pull up a Google Doc. Just if you don't really care about this, and I say share screen, you should have an option to just say stop share if you don't really want to see what, and you just would rather, you know, see what you see usually on Zoom. If you have any problems opening a Google Doc, or if you prefer to open a PDF, then I am sharing a link to a PDF in the chat. And I will share screen though, if you would just prefer to have me do the work. Oh, I need to be made co-host. Please. Paul, are you working on that?
Or someone else? You should have it now.
Ah, all of my powers have opened up. Breakout rooms, sharing screen. All right. So, these kanji, I found this passage was fairly straightforward, but I still thought it would be fun to look at it. So it is, this is just that first sentence. So shobutsu is all Buddhas. Sho is like everything, all, and butsu is Buddha. No makes that the all Buddhas a subject. Masashiku is truly or surely or genuinely. And then shobutsu, so naru is become or are, and tokiwa is when. So all Buddhas become, when all Buddhas become. And then the rest of the sentence is on that next line. So jiko is a word for self, and wa makes that a subject. And shobutsu nari, all Buddhas are. And then actually the sentence continues on the next line. To kakuchi, so no, learn or perceive. Suru koto is doing, and o makes knowing and perceiving the doing, the object, and mochizu, or need or use, and not, so it negates, it's not needed. So knowing, learning, perceiving is not needed when all Buddhas become Buddhas. So just looking at those kanji, oh, let's see, and then the next part. So, shika are domo, so in a way, all Buddhas are, and then butsu is the object again, that all Buddhas verify, confirm, and make continue, so they continue verifying. So you can go, can you know, just puzzle over those kanji while I'm going to share with you 6 different translations of this phrase. So you can get a little bit of a sense of, like, you know, this is the wonder and the frustration of translation, that, you know, that these are presumably, these are all like people who are qualified to translate, and they come up with these different things. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they don't need to perceive they are Buddhas. However, they are enlightened Buddhas, and they continue actualizing Buddha. So that's Shohaku Okumura's. So that actualizing is a little bit of a... So when they say verify, confirm, make, continue, I mean, the actualizing, I think, is a bit of a interpretation. Because actualize in this context means to, you know, make real. So if we awaken to reality, we might kind of just awaken to it intellectually or something, but what's important is that we make it in actuality. We manifest it, we live it in our life. Another translation, and I don't know who these subsequent ones are. I borrowed this from a text and I didn't have a chance to look it up. When Buddhas are genuinely Buddhas, there is no need for them to be conscious that they are Buddhas. Yet they are realized Buddhas, and they continue to realize Buddha. When Buddhas are really Buddhas, we do not need to know our identity with the Buddhas, but we are enlightened Buddhas and express the Buddha in daily life. There is no need to know that one is identical with Buddha when Buddha is truly Buddha. For a truly enlightened Buddha expresses his Buddhahood in his daily life. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, they are not necessarily aware of themselves as Buddhas, but they are enlightened ones. They advance in enlightenment. When Buddhas are truly Buddhas, there is no means by which the self is aware of being Buddha. However, it is the realized Buddha, and further advances in realizing Buddha. So that's an interesting one. There is no means by which the self is aware of being Buddha. So I have a question for small groups tonight, but I wanted to first ask people, What is a Buddha? I mean, obviously, in the classic, the classic Buddhist definition, right? A Buddha is a being that has awakened completely. Okay, but what is that? What, you know, do you think there are such a thing as a Buddha? What is a Buddha? And I always think of this as kind of helpful to to imagine that somebody who's not a Buddhist is asking you this question, and you're really trying to, you know, get it across. Like, why do Buddhists find the ideal of a Buddha inspiring or helpful in any way? You know, what is a Buddha? Because if you just give them some kind of, you know, oh, well, they've experienced enlightenment, well, that opens up a whole new bunch of new questions, right? So ideally, you don't use just typical Buddhist terminology, but kind of put it in terms that anyone can understand. So I don't know. Does anybody have a stab at, like, what? How would you define a Buddha? Someone who is complete.
Someone who is no longer managed by his desires.
I think an important thing would be someone who is selfless. They're still very engaged in everything, but they're not, you know, they're focused on their self, or issues about their self are just not there.
Someone who's ended suffering.
Mick.
I don't even know if it's like a fixed permanent thing. Like, it was interesting. You know, he says, like, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, and I think that, like, a person can be a Buddha from one moment to the next, but then not, like, all the time. Like, a Buddha can, like, kind of emerge from someone in a moment and then just kind of recede back, I guess, after that.
When they're really Buddhas. Yeah, like that.
I would think it's someone who's not thinking of themselves, but always thinking of others in moments, maybe.
I'll add another one. Someone who has stopped making the distinction between self and other. Mm-hmm.
I like the word magnanimous, the one that that Dogen talks about in the Tenzo Kyokan, which is like big, like the ocean, and can just, you know, receive things without getting upset. Erica.
I think maybe somebody who walks a spiritual path and knows that they don't have the answers.
Mm.
I was going to say somebody without a gap to bridge.
Yeah, we've talked about the Genjo Koan as being about closing the gap, you know, between the independent dependent dimensions. Integrated. Paulette.
I don't know, maybe somebody who's aware, like, to the point where they can see, you know, when something's arising and they can respond before it actually happens. I remember, like, hearing the Dalai Lama talk about, like, afflictive emotions, and he said that it's not that I don't feel anger, and it's not that I don't feel these afflictive emotions, it's that I just don't respond to them. And that always stuck with me.
Yeah, definitely. Very, very aware of inside and out. Well, I wanted to kind of get the juices flowing a little more by going into small groups for a little while. And if Paul, if you would give us maybe 10 minutes, is 10 minutes enough? I guess I'll tell you what I was going to say. Hopefully the groups will be small enough, three people, maybe if necessary four, because it doesn't always end up splitting out evenly. And asking each person, if you don't mind, to think of someone who you really admire. Maybe you have more than one person, but to try to think of one person you just really admire, and they maybe they're not around anymore, maybe they are, but you admire who they are as a person. You know, in a sense, you can think in the way that they manifest, you know, some portion of this, there's some Buddha nature shining through them. And they don't have to be perfect by any means. We don't have to be suggesting that this person is a Buddha or whatever, but more like, you know, like we're saying, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, like this person, at least in along certain times, along certain parameters, they manifest something that really deeply inspires you, and then, you know, share what that is with the group. Identify the one thing that you admire the most about them, and then if you wouldn't mind just choosing a secretary to just record that part, right? What did you admire the most? So hopefully if there's three people in the group, we get three, you know, things, and four, then you get four things. And we'll just share that back. So I see it's 8:31 Pacific time, 8:41 or so. So give us 10 minutes. Sweet. So I hope your group was as fun as ours. I'll start everything off by sharing what we talked about. So interestingly, we talked about our dad, our father-in-law, our dad, and our mom. So one person was remarkable because of their humility, and particularly in treating everyone equally, regardless of, you know, his own success or status or whatever relative to the other person, just always treated everyone equally. Also patient and meticulous, even-keeled, non-judgmental, someone who never talked about people, never badmouthed people, was non-judgmental. And my mom, who is completely unself-consciously generous to anyone. She has something you need or something she can help you with, it's yours. All right, another group. Tyler.
Yeah, we had sort of similar lists of people, a lot of kind of parents or that sort of, or grandparents that were on our list. We had sort of someone who extends themselves to others was one, and along with that, someone else had a parent who is just like incredibly selfless. And so I think I guess it's different necessarily than extending oneself to others, but kind of around the same theme. And we had a parent whose ability to challenge their own ideas consistently throughout their life. So, kind of an unending compassion for others was another example of a friend. And then I said, someone who had a kind of a natural mentality towards empathy of others. So those were sort of the key words that came out of ours.
Thank you. Mick?
So we didn't have any parents, but we did have sort of like compassion and kindness was a big one. And sort of like consistently compassionate and kind over a long relationship. We had two for honesty, which, you know, my thought about honesty is that it's always difficult and not necessarily rewarding for like everyone around you to be honest. When you're kind to people, they like it, but when you're honest with them, sometimes they won't. And that's kind of the thing that I admired in my spouse, is that she is like always honest, and I don't know, it just, something about it makes it seem like they don't need to try to change the world for me or anybody else. They're just okay with the way that it is. So that was our.
Jeff? Oh, you're still muted.
Oh yes, the pesky mute button. In our group, we broadened our consideration to all sentient beings. And we had a discussion about a lovely cat that is very much inclined to defer to her partner and let her go first at the food bowl. Or if there's cuddling to be had, then she waits until her friend is done cuddling and then she takes her turn. Domio, you were mentioned for your emotional honesty. The Dalai Lama was referred to for his incredible composure. A friend was mentioned, someone who's suffered a lot of losses and difficult experiences, and yet has experienced as having very little in the way of troublesome ego. And is always generous and lacks self-consciousness. I gave an example of my wife, Loretta, of 44 years, who ever since I was first getting to know her has always had this incredible way of discerning what others need or like or what delights people, and then finding clever ways to remember that and delight them, from the neighbor boy that's 1 year old and just learning to walk to people that she's just meeting. And so I admire that about her.
Thank you. Mark?
We had mention of a friend who was at ease with people and good humored and kind of the place where drama goes to die. Hmm. Very collected and with a strong sense that we're all in this together. We had a meditation teacher who was described as nun-like, a listener, poised, kind, compassionate, but still able to maintain boundaries. And we had mention of a literal nun who was notable in her sincerity, attentiveness, practicality, and calmness.
Thank you. There another group? Or is that all of them?
So with our group, we had two grandpas and a dad. One grandpa for his respect for women. Another grandpa who was a judge and just always did the right thing at the right time. And then a dad that In his older years was more like slowed down, unperturbed, and just always like taking things in, along with some other, like, you know, sort of advocates slash like Zen teachers. And something that we kind of talked a little bit about was the fact that like a Buddha is somebody that's among us, you know, not somebody like above us, it's somebody, or at least one of those role models. It's like the kind of what we were thinking with like family members is that it's somebody that, you know, you can kind of emulate, you can see yourself in them, sort of thing. Yeah, that's it.
So I'm hoping this gives some groundedness and reality to this idea that Buddhas don't need to perceive themselves as Buddhas. Mm-hmm. And nonetheless, they continue actualizing Buddha. What does that mean? And what does, like, why is that necessary for Dogen to say? Why is it, as practitioners, might we be thinking that, like, Buddhas need to perceive they're Buddhas, or we need to perceive when we're Buddhas, or when we're not Buddhas, or when we're ordinary beings?
It's a judgment, right? And part of it is being free from judgment.
Well, but this came up in, maybe it was 2 weeks ago. What exactly we were talking about, but
do you want to move that chair over by?
Okay.
Yeah. Move that chair a little closer to the microphone.
Yeah. So this, something similar to this came up a couple of weeks ago when we were talking about this, and my thought after class was, don't you have to, like, be enlightened every moment and then it's gone, and then every moment. I mean, it's not like you just reach this level and then you're just at this level. It's like every moment is different, and, you know, so is that what actualizing means? I mean,
but you could actualize something other than being a Buddha. So what does it mean to actualize Buddha in that moment?
Does that mean being enlightened in that moment? I mean, I don't know. Yeah, I don't. Huh.
I guess it's like in accord with reality, right? Mm-hmm. Or Buddha's like all the things that we're describing are like qualities of someone who's in accord with reality in some way, right? Maybe not in some grand, like, they understand the whole universe and they're completely enlightened kind of way, but,
you know. So is actualizing reality the same as being a Buddha?
Good question. I think,
you know, so does that mean actualizing Buddha, does that mean you're seeing reality?
And you're seeing it, and you are living it.
Yeah,
like you are living in accord with it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So maybe it's like, in part, is that you can be living in accord with reality, and therefore be manifesting these qualities of a Buddha without thinking, mm-hmm. Yeah,
right,
I got it. I got it this moment. That was good. I'm actualizing, but like without necessarily, because it's like all the people that we're describing, most of the people we're describing anyway, are not necessarily, you know, awakened in some kind of classical Buddhist sense to, you know, the two dimensions of reality and blah, blah, blah.
Right.
But they're awakened to something. They're mm-hmm. they're acting in accord with the fact that, you know, we're all in this together, and, you know, these, they're reflecting that, or that, or, you know, in terms of generosity, that, you know, we don't really own anything, and we're not really responsible for anything that comes to us. We just, it's a, just a flow. So they're acting in accord with that. Tyler.
Yeah, I guess that was, I mean, I think it's, yeah, how people are acting. But if anyone's like, hey, like right here, this guy's a Buddha, right? Like, that's me, everybody. I feel like I'd be like a pretty red flag that they're not, right? Like, if anyone's, you can look at like spiritual leaders that are like, you know, have these big organizations that are like all about them, and they talk about how great they're, you know, there's something up, right? Like, it's not really about that. So I think it's, yeah, and then those who are just being in any given moment, you know, I think that those, without having to know that they are or whatever, yeah, that's kind of what I popped into my head. Someone who's saying they
but
are.
But then how do we know we're on the right course? I mean, how do we know, like, because we have to know to some extent, right? Like, otherwise practice would be pointless if there was no way to, like, you know, have an aspiration and, you know, take steps along a path that are moving you closer to an aspiration, and to, you know, verify that you're like, okay, I'm acting more in accord with reality now.
I feel like maybe it's a state of goodness, you know, and like the reason why everybody is describing it differently is because it's kind of like a diamond or a prism. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. if you turn it one way, you see it this way, you turn it this way, you see this other quality. And so there's probably not a way for us to embody every side mm-hmm. of it. But we all have our natural tendencies where we can really access certain parts of it. That is what I thought when I was hearing all of these beautiful qualities being described. So.
I'll just add that I think you know you're improving if you notice yourself suffering less and being less self-identified.
Yeah, it's a funny question, because, you know, there's that whole thing of like the moment you go, oh yeah, you know, I'm actualizing Buddha. Then something's a little off, but so I think this is an ongoing, like, koan of practice. Like, we do have to try and judge sometimes, but then really it's like, maybe that's to get back to, like, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, you know, when it's like, when we're really in accord with reality, like, it's not necessarily anything self-conscious, not necessarily anything that we're aware of. Then at other times, you know, we can look back and evaluate perhaps and be like, oh, you know. Chris?
Well, one thing that I've heard you say multiple times, it's stuck with me and changed my own relationship to the question, is that not measuring yourself in terms of progress towards the aspiration, but in sincerity of the effort. And it's like, if you're doing it, you're doing it. And you may be doing it well, or you may be doing it poorly, but you're doing it. So therefore you're doing it. And that kind of seems to ride along with a lot of what I see in the various texts that I've looked at. If you're doing it, you're doing it.
Oh, I hope y'all like going through this one sentence at a time. I feel like there's so much to be gotten out of it. What's the point of me like whipping through that second sentence to give you some kind of, I don't know, and this is what that means, and then you go home, who cares? You know, unless you really, you know, engage it and chew on it a little bit. I don't know. Not all texts can you do this with, but definitely Genjo Koan. Every sentence is like, what is that? All right, well, thank you so much for joining. I'll say our closing verse. Dedicate the merit of this Sangha meaning to all so that they may be able to obtain the truth. All Buddhas throughout space and time, all honored ones, Bodhisattvas, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. Thank you all for coming. Thank you.